WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, The Message. Millie Mel was the rapper on the 1982 hit, hailed as the first rap record with a social message. Now he performs on a new version of The Message. We'll talk with Millie Mel about the early days of rap and about how the music and his life have changed. Also, music from the city streets of Australia. We'll talk with Archie Roach. At the age of 3, the Australian government took him away from his Aboriginal family and placed him in a foster home as part of a program intended to assimilate Aboriginals. He ran away at 14 to live on the streets. Now at 37, he's writing and performing his own music, and his debut album has just been released. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews Susan Sontag's new novel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Democratic presidential candidate Bill Clinton is trying to keep the pressure on President Bush in the area of foreign policy. Today, Clinton called for urgent action to stop alleged atrocities in former Yugoslavia. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
In a statement issued from his Little Rock headquarters, Clinton said that confirmed reports show that thousands of Croats and Slavic Muslims have been tortured and killed in secret detention camps run by Serbians. Comparing the events in Yugoslavia to the horrors of the Holocaust, Clinton asked the United States to call for an emergency session of the United Nations and urged that military action be taken if necessary to close down the camps. Today, the State Department contradicted an earlier statement about the camps, saying it could not confirm reports that Serbian forces were operating death camps. In the past several weeks, a growing chorus of editorial writers and Democrats have been calling for stronger action. Today, Assistant Secretary of State Tom Niles told Congress that the U.S. is working with its allies on a United Nations resolution that would authorize military force to support the relief efforts. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Bush administration stressed today that it cannot confirm the reports that Serbian authorities in Bosnia have set up Nazi-style detention camps where Muslim and Croatian civilians have been tortured and killed. Assistant Secretary of State Thomas Niles told a House panel today that the administration has seen the reports and was deeply concerned about them. He stressed that the reports have not been verified. That statement appeared to contradict a statement yesterday from State Department spokesman Richard Boucher, who said the administration had confirmed reports of atrocities and killings. Serbian authorities have denied the Red Cross access to the detention camps, but readily admit to what they call ethnic cleansing, that is, expulsion of other ethnic groups from lands they control. Germany's highest constitutional court prevented a newly liberalized abortion law from taking effect today. Deirdre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
After the German parliament agreed earlier this summer to liberalize West Germany's restrictive abortion regulations, dissenting parliamentary delegates took the new law to court. The law would mean an easing of access to abortion in the western part of Germany while imposing restrictions on eastern Germany's liberal abortion on demand regulations. Conservatives protest that the new law does not adequately fulfill the constitutional provision of the protection of life. The judges in Karlsruhe today ruled the new law cannot take effect until the highest court rules on its constitutionality. The judgment is expected later this year. In the meantime, separate abortion regulations will continue to be valid in East and West Germany. Political observers fear today's ruling means the court will overturn the newly liberalized abortion law. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 11 points to close at 3,384. This is NPR. The space shuttle's tethered satellite is finally floating into space. After several hours of delays, payload commander Jeff Hoffman was jubilant as he told Mission Control the satellite was drifting smoothly away from Atlantis. Pictures beamed down from space show the ball-shaped satellite looking something like a huge helium-filled balloon at the end of a long string. Earlier, the astronauts managed to free a stuck power cable on the satellite after 3 hours of trying. They then began to release the satellite, but immediately stopped the experiment when the half-ton metal ball began to rock from side to side. A poll published today in France shows that opposition to the Maastricht Treaty on European Union is gaining ground. A referendum on the treaty will be held in September. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
The survey shows that 43% of those polled are against the Maastricht Treaty, while 57% said they would vote yes in the referendum. Although those in favor are still in the majority, survey indicates that support for the treaty is waning. A poll taken 2 months ago showed greater support for European Union. All mainstream parties on the right and the left are campaigning for a yes vote, but opposition politicians fear the widespread disillusionment with the socialist government could influence some voters to oppose the treaty. President François Mitterrand, who's clearly aware of that danger, has made it clear that regardless of the results in the referendum, he will not resign. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Fire officials in the western states say that 26 major wildfires are now blackening almost 150,000 acres. Officials warn that the worst may be yet to come because weather forecasts predict more hot weather, gusty winds, and lightning strikes around the biggest fires in Wyoming, southern Oregon, and Idaho. More than 10,000 firefighters are on the fire lines. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The people who said back in the 70s that rap music was a novelty which wouldn't last were obviously wrong. We're going to meet a rapper who had some of the best rap records of the early 80s. He's Melly Mel, who's best known for the records he made with Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. One of their records, The Message, is considered the first rap record with social commentary and one of the best rap records ever made.
Broken glass everywhere, people pissing on the stage, you know they just don't care. I can't take the smell, can't take the noise, got no money to move out, I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room, roaches in the back, junkies in the alley with the baseball bat. I tried to get away, but I couldn't get far, cause a man with a tow truck repossessed my car. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Standing on the front stoop, hanging out the window, watching all the cars go by, roaring as the breezes blow. A crazy lady living in a bag, eating out of garbage pails, used to be a fag hag. Such a dance to tango, skipped the life and dangle. A zircon princess seemed to lost her senses. Down at the peep show, watching all the creeps, so she could tell her stories to the girls back home. She went to the city and got so did it. She had to get a pimp, she couldn't make it on her own. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
There's a new version of The Message. A young rock musician from Denmark named Nikolaj Steen wanted to feature a rock version of The Message on his new album, so he tracked down Melly Mel, who had coincidentally already written a new lyric. They collaborated on several mixes of The New Message, which have been released on a new CD of the same name.
We got broken glass everywhere. People pissing on the stairs because they just don't care. Can't take the smell, I can't take the noise. Got no money to move out, I got no choice.
Rats in the front room, roaches in the back, junkies in the yard just smoking that crack. I try to get away because life is a drag, but the tow truck man came and took my dad.
Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge.
I'm trying not to lose my head.
It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
A little girl shot down, caught in the crossfire. Drug deal with bad brother went haywire. Squeeze off 10 shots, but only one hit. Missed the funeral, but can't afford an outfit. What about the derelicts?
Say the world's insane.
They call you a heretic.
Food stamps,
army, welfare, Medicaid.
Celebrating Earth Day.
Filling up the Everglades. Took the train cause the cabbie got gunned down. A water main break, can't go downtown. I should've stayed off, cops getting paid off. Pops got laid off, he tried to play it off. Up at dawn, home at dusk, he's flipping. Mad at the world, so he gave me a whipping.
He ran out of cigarettes.
He went for another pack.
It must have been a good smoke.
He never came back.
When Melly Mel recorded the original version of The Message, most rap records were party boasts. The Message was a departure for Melly Mel. It was actually his record company which brought him the original lyric of The Message, which was written by rapper Duke Booty.
Our group, like Flash and the Furious Five, we didn't actually want to do The Message because we was used to doing party raps, you know, and like boasting about how good we are and all that. And when the record company brought the record to us to do. We didn't actually want to do it. And I was the only one that, like, I just caved in. I said, listen, if this is the record we're going to do, then I'll just do it, and it's no big thing. But I didn't think that it would be pivotal either way, you know, like on a good or bad end. I just thought it was going to be just another record that we had did.
So did you ever try the message at parties before you went into the recording studio, or would that have been all wrong?
No, we never tried it. And as a matter of fact, I was shocked because we used to hang out in a club called Disco Fever up in the Bronx, right? And then they took the record, you know, they was testing it, like they tested it down on a record shop on 125th Street. You know, just putting it, you know, just letting it play and people outside, you know, listening to it. And then they tested it in the club where we hung out at, and the people really liked it. And that was coming right behind Planet Rock, which was a big, big record back then. And when they played the message in the club and the people liked it, I was kind of shocked because I didn't think that, you know, coming from Planet Rock to, you know, a serious record like The Message, I didn't think that, I thought it would be like a lapse in you know, the level of the crowd, the intensity of the crowd. But it wasn't, so, yeah. Right then, I knew that the record was going to be more than what I thought it was going to be.
Can I ask you how you started rapping?
Well, we started going to parties. They used to be like little, like maybe $1 parties, $2 parties, and they had a DJ called Kool Herc. They was all DJs, but they rapped. They didn't actually rap in rhythm, but they used to say little phrases, you know. Coke LaRock, Timmy Tim, and Clark Kent, that was the guys' names. And they was the big DJs. They was like the big DJs back then. And we used to go to their parties. And I just started rapping, just trying to emulate them, you know, to be like them, because they was like more or less our heroes back then.
What were some of the kinds of rhymes they were using?
They wouldn't use rhymes. It's like, if you could imagine, it would be like a dark room or a gym, and it's like smoky, because everybody was smoking everything from cigarettes to whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they be playing the music, and then it'll all be echo chamber. So they'd be like, rock, 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 free, free, free. You know,
right.
It was like more or less like kind of a psychedelic kind of thing, because everything they said, it was echoes, you know. And this is why they call me the Shoe Machine Shock, y'all. You know, it was like all this echoing. And you walk in there, you'd be like dumbfounded, because it's like you just stepped into another world, you know what I mean? And there's all these dark figures around and smoke and, you know, it was like awesome. You know, for us, it was like a rush, you know, just stepping into these parties.
So what were the early rhymes you were doing?
We was doing like, you know, I'm Melly Mel and I rock so well from the top of the world to the depths of hell. This is my first rhyme. I rock with the best, with the most finesse. I'm taking the top and leaving what's left. Like real simple stuff, you know, just boasting rhymes, you know, nothing real heavy or nothing like that, or nothing real technical, because there was no technique. We was just going by our own thing.
How did you come up with your name, Melly Mel?
Flash gave me that name, because my name was just Melvin, so I don't think that would be like a cool name, like,
right.
You know, MC Melvin. So Flash, you know, he started calling me Melly Mel, and it stuck.
Where were the parties held?
In gyms, in not too many halls. We did basically the first halls, but it was like in gyms and like little social club type things. I think Herc the Hevelo, that was, I guess, was a club. I never was there, but he used to play in the PAL, and that was like a gym. You know, little halls, you know, nothing big or extravagant. But it was like, you know, nice little small dark joints, you know, real comfortable, sweaty, you know.
Was there often trouble at the parties?
Yeah, but like the trouble at the parties was like it was set up like, it was nothing going on in the party itself, right? But all the guys that, like, did stick-ups and stuff like that, they'd be in the bathroom. So when you went to the bathroom, if you didn't know these guys, then they'd rob you. So that it wasn't like how it is now, like guys would actually be in the party itself and shoot up the party, or maybe they come outside and shoot up the party. If you got shot, you might get shot in the bathroom. You know, that was, like, the only spot that you'd have to be wary of, basically. And then you did have your isolated instances, you know, something happening outside, but it would never happen in the party, so to speak. It'd always be like away from the party.
So would you go to the bathroom? Did you know enough people that
it was
safe for you to go?
I knew everybody, so it was definitely safe. I knew, you know, from, 'cause before I was rapping, I used to be a dancer, so, you know, I just met like all of the stick up guys, all the dope dealing guys. I knew them all. Or if I didn't know them, I was familiar with them. So, you know, if it's a familiar face, they might let you come and go, you know. And I wasn't no sharp dress. I didn't have no jewelry or nothing like that, or no clean sneakers, or, you know, something that, you know, they would want to take. So, you know, I was always safe.
What was the transition like for you from parties to recording studios and concert dates, theaters?
Well, it definitely wasn't hard to do, because even when we was doing, like, the parties, we seen ourselves, like, we put ourselves on an entertainment's level, or entertainer's level. It's like we used to set up, you know, tables and build our own little stage and do our little dance routines. So it wasn't nothing for us to go from, you know, point A to point. As far as rappers go, it's like when Rappers Delight, when Sugar Hill Gang made Rappers Delight, and when we did our first show with them, we blew them out.
What was it like when you started making more money and getting really well known? How did you handle that? I think that's difficult for a lot of people to handle.
Yeah, and I guess it was especially difficult for us back then, because, you know, we started, you know, abusing a lot of things, you know, abusing the money, you know, and messing with drugs and stuff like that, you know, hanging out. You know, we got into that kind of thing. So I guess, and we didn't really have no good management or somebody that we looked up to tell us what to do and what not to do in moderation, or what was cool, or what was going to be what was going to add to our longevity, because, you know, we was just out there and we was on top, and we just thought that, you know, things was never going to run out, and, you know, eventually they did, because we was very abusive about our career.
So what happened when things ran out?
Well, everybody just, you know, went their own direction. You know, it's like at one point Flash and them had took up a lawsuit against the record company, and, you know, some of the brothers was using drugs. I started using drugs. You know, everything just got real herky jerky.
Rapper Millie Mel is my guest. He has a new version of his hit, The Message. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Rapper Millie Mel is my guest. Another great record that you made was White Lines, which is a kind of anti-cocaine record. You know,
right.
So White Lines, don't do it.
Right.
So here you were actually doing drugs while you were making the rap?
Right. But, you know, see, the whole thing with White Lines is I didn't want to try to make an anti-cocaine song or a song that glorified cocaine. I just wanted to make a song about cocaine, and that was a hit song. Because the music that we used, it wasn't original music. We used it, you know, it was like a club song, Liquid. That was the name of the song. And, you know, I used to be in the club, and it's like, if you ever hear a song and sing your own words to it, in other words, and they were saying something in their record, and every time I would hear it, I would just say, White Lines, you know. And I was like, you know, it could be a good idea to make a song. And that was all a part of the scene anyway, you know, the club scene back then. It was like, cocaine then, it wasn't like how it is now. It was more fashionable, you know what I mean? It was fashionable to have it. And I started out not even, you know, I didn't use cocaine. I used to just have it because it was fashionable just to have it. You come in the club, you know, everybody know you got blow, girls know you got coke, and, you know, it was in the euphoria of that, just having it, and people that know you have it, and they treat you better. And that's that all that accumulated to me writing that song, you know, because that's the lifestyle that I was in. I wasn't around nobody that didn't use drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was the lifestyle I was in. So the song was, for that time, it was like the perfect song to write. For that music and that time, it was the perfect song.
Ticket to ride, White Line Highway. Tell all your friends they can go my way. Pay your toll, sell your soul. Pound for pound, cost more than gold. The longer you stay, the more you pay. My white lines go a long way. Either up your nose or through your vein. With nothing to gain except killing your brain.
How did you come up with the idea of using the higher?
That was just something that came naturally with the song, with the twist and shout thing. Mm-hmm. It just came natural. That was like, you know, me piecing it together in my mind after the verse, and it's higher, baby, higher, you know, and it all fell together. It was something real natural. As a matter of fact, before I even did the song, I even had a dream that went after that I did the song and I heard it and I was in the club and the song was playing. So it's like I heard the song in my head even before we even did the record. So I knew exactly how I wanted the record to sound, so to speak.
If you're just joining us, my guest is rapper Melly Mel. Where do you live now? Do you still live in the South Bronx?
Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. Bed-Stuy.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a family? Or?
Yeah, yeah. I have family, kids. I have kids. You know. Uh-huh. Oh, nine.
Can I ask you about your family when you were growing up?
Well, our family was more or less, say, not really a dysfunctional family, but it was, you know, it was like my pops drank. And, you know, him and my mother, they couldn't read, so they, you know, used to make us go to school. You know, the important thing was learning how to read. And, you know, it was like that. He drank, and he was abusive. So it's like not the average ghetto family, but, you know, that's nothing new as far as, you know, ghettos go.
So was reading important to you? Did you like to read?
Well, I didn't like to read, but I knew if I did read, or if I could learn how to read, you know, things would be easier, you know.
So when did like words start really meaning something to you?
When I started rapping, because mm-hmm. that's when I understood, you know, how you could put the right words together and make, it's almost like making magic, especially when you rhyme. It's like I used to always think back to, you see a witch in front of a cauldron and she's stirring up and she's saying like a rhyme. You know, it always would be a rhyme of all things. And it's like, and to me, my rhymes is like, it's like magic. You know, you could make your own magic, especially if you believe, if you're saying something and you believe in what it is that you're saying, is like magic once you put the right words together.
Did you ever go through a period in your life when things were hard, when you were busted for anything and ended up having to do time?
Oh yeah, when I was very young though, that was all before I started rapping. Like, you know, just being out in the streets, you know, and running around, you know, robbing people, you know, doing stuff like that, like stupid stuff.
Now, how much time did you spend in prison?
I didn't spend no real time. I spent like say 11 days in juvenile prison, uh-huh. and I spent 5 days in Rikers Island because I lied, right? And I told the cops that I was overage. Because I didn't want my family. It's like when you get busted at a young age and it's late, right? They'll call your house or they'll send the cops to your house and your mother would have to come pick you up. But I didn't want to have to go through that because I knew I'd get a whooping or whatever, right? And I told the cops that I was older and then they sent me to Rikers Island for 5 days.
Was that a terrifying experience?
Not really. You know, thinking back on it, I guess I was scared then, but you know, I think I was more scared of getting a whooping if my moms and pops would have came to get me. So
that's kind of amazing. You'd be more afraid of what your parents were going to do than spending a few days in Rikers Island, which is really one of the worst prisons.
Well, that's what happens when you have a father, you see, because you got to be afraid of your father. And that's how you get respect for law, you know, because somebody's got to be the head. So you definitely was afraid, you know, of what your father would do. That's like the biggest, you know, that's your biggest fear.
So after a few days in prison, did that scare you away from doing anything that would land you back in prison, or did you feel, well, I can take this, I can manage this?
No, what it was like being in prison and seeing what prison life is so pathetic. It was so pathetic to me that the only time that if I wanted to do a crime, it would have to be like for hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. Because, I mean, when you see guys in prison. And I've got like not really went to prison, but like being arrested and being like in the bullpen area, like or central booking or whatever. And the stuff that guys get busted for that are in prison is like you'll never see like a John Gotti or, you know, some. You see like a guy, you know, he smacked his wife on the leg or, you know, somebody that robbed a little corner store. Those are the guys that are in prison. And then they all think they know so much about the law and, you know, they're taking each other's sneakers. It's so pathetic. It's so pathetic that anybody with a right mind wouldn't even want to be in jail for, you know, no longer than they would have to stay there. Like that two-time loser or the three-time loser, he's a fool because he is nothing in jail except for a bunch of guys that don't even know why they in jail. They too stupid to know that they in jail because they were stupid enough to do something and get caught. And that's all the guys that's in jail. And I didn't think that. I knew that I was too smart to be that stupid, you know, just to do something. And then, you know, oh, man, the policeman or the white man, you know, you did something stupid and you got caught. You were stupid enough to get caught.
Yeah. What do you think of some of the directions rap has been heading in lately?
I think that whatever direction rap goes, it can't really be a bad thing, because it's like, you know, you got brothers that never had, you know, chances to do anything or go anywhere, and now they're getting the chance to be somebody, you know what I mean? Because other than that, the average rapper would probably be nobody. Most of us are probably misfits anyway. But the thing is that they don't draw a line between the records that they make and reality. It's like if you were to take the hardcore rapper or the average, you know, political rapper, and they're making the records because they're trying to connect with a certain audience. But they don't. The only thing that's wrong is that they never tell the audience the reality about what they're all about, or the reality about what their music is supposed to be. It's like, in essence, if you go to see Lethal Weapon in the movies, you wouldn't come out the movie trying to kill nobody or trying to be like Mel Gibson. Or if you were to go see the Aliens, you wouldn't come out the movie wanting to be like a monster. But the guys that make these records, they give you the inception in your mind that after you listen to their record, then you're supposed to act a certain way. Or they don't tell the people that it's not cool to act that way. That, you know, you couldn't get by acting like a gangster. That's not a normal life. Or you couldn't get by in society being like on that totally pro-black Afrocentric kick, because it is not going to blend with whatever you got to do with society. And then it kind of gives the kids the anti-establishment state of mind, and it's not helping them now.
I got one last question for you. On your like official documents, credit cards if you have them, or driver's license, do you use the name Melly Mel, or do you use your birth name?
No, my birth name, Melvin Glover. That's my name.
So how do you feel about that name now?
It's a nice name. You know, I don't really think here nor there about it. You know, some people hear the name Glover, they say, are you related to Danny Glover? I'd be like, my pops was named Danny Glover.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh. That's interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, thanks so much for talking with us.
Anytime.
Melly Mel has a new version of The Message on Imago Records. Here's more from the original Message. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Walking around like your pretty boy Floyd, turned stick up kid, but look what you done did. Got sent up for an 8-year bid. Now your manhood is took and you're a make tag. Spend the next 2 years as an undercover fag, being used and abused to serve like hell, till one day you was found hung dead in a cell. It was plain to see that your life was lost. You was cold and your body swung back and forth, but now your eyes sing the sad, sad song of how you live so fast and die so young. So don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
Yo, Mel, you see that girl, man?
Yeah, man.
Yo, that sound like Cowboy,
what's
man.
Up, fool?
Yo, what's up, money?
Yo.
Hey, where's Creel and Raheem, man?
Lay upstairs cooling out.
So what's up for the night, y'all?
Yo, we can go down to Fever, man.
Let's go check out Junebug, man.
Hey, yo, you know that girl Betty?
Yeah, man.
My mom's got robbed, man.
Not
what?
Again,
she got hurt.
What
bad.
Did this happen? When did this happen?
What's going on? Free. Don't nobody move nothing. Y'all know what this is. Get
what's
him up.
What?
Get him
yo,
up.
Yo, man, we down with Grand Master Flash and the Furious Five.
What is that, a gang?
No.
Just shut up. Hey, shut up. I don't want to hear you up now.
Shut up. Officer, what's the problem?
Ain't no beautiful problem. That's my beautiful problem.
Yo, you ain't got to push
it, man. Get in the car. Get in the car.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Native Born. Archie Roach was born to an Australian Aboriginal family, but was taken away from his home at the age of 3. He was placed in a foster home by the Australian government as part of a policy intended to assimilate Aboriginals. As a teenager, he ran away from his foster home and ended up on the streets. We'll talk with Archie Roach about how he started writing songs and about his first album, which was just released. Also, writer Susan Sontag has turned to a new and somewhat improbable form, the historical romance. Book critic John Leonard has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. The United Nations Security Council demanded today that all detention camps in the former Yugoslavia be open to the Red Cross and other neutral international organizations. The non-binding statement was adopted unanimously by the Council's 15 members. It follows reports that Serbs are torturing and killing Muslims and Croats in camps in Bosnia. The United Nations has suspended relief flights to Bosnia's capital for 3 days because of increased attacks on the Sarajevo airport. A funeral party was fired upon today as mourners buried 2 infants killed by sniper fire this week. Reporters say the attack appeared intentional. The space shuttle Atlantis has finally released a tethered satellite into space. After hours of delay, the astronauts told Mission Control the satellite was drifting smoothly away. NASA and the Italian Space Agency have invested close to $380 million in the tethered satellite system. NASA provided the tether and the deploying tower. Italy supplied the satellite. Italian scientists have been working on the concept for 20 years. The African National Congress today claimed victory against white rule after a 2-day national strike by millions of black South Africans. At least 27 people were killed Monday and Tuesday in fighting in the townships. The ANC says about 4 million blacks stayed home from work, or about 90% of the black workforce. Today, the Bush administration said it cannot confirm a press report that Serbian authorities are killing hundreds of Croatian and Muslim civilians in detention centers. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The report first appeared in New York Newsday, and yesterday the State Department seemed to back up the account when spokesman Richard Boucher said, "We do have our own reports, similar to reports in the press, about detention centers where torture and killings take place." But today, Assistant Secretary of State Thomas Niles said yesterday's comment was not intended to confirm the Newsday report.
We don't have confirming information about these alleged atrocities.
The State Department says it's waiting for the Red Cross to investigate. By declining to confirm the existence of death camps, the administration may hope to forestall demands that the U.S. use military power in former Yugoslavia, something the administration does not want to do, except to ensure delivery of humanitarian aid and only after the United Nations gives its approval. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Colombia's foreign minister says his country will stop using U.S. aircraft to look for fugitive drug lord Pablo Escobar. American planes with special surveillance gear were helping the Colombian search for Escobar. The foreign minister gave no reason for the decision. On Monday, U.S. military sources said their planes found Escobar in a stronghold guarded by about 1,000 Colombian troops. Colombian officials deny Escobar has been found. Stock prices closed mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrials lost 11 points. This is NPR News. The government's chief economic barometer dipped in June. It's the first decline in 6 months, and analysts say it's further evidence that the economic recovery is losing steam. NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
The Index of Leading Economic Indicators is designed to help predict what the economy will be doing 6 to 9 months in the future. In June, that index dropped by 0.2%. Among the reasons for the less optimistic outlook are a weaker money supply, a shorter work week, and lower consumer expectations. Among the positive signs, new orders for business equipment and a rise in orders for consumer goods. On Friday, the Labor Department releases the most politically charged economic statistic, the latest unemployment rate. Most analysts are predicting that after reaching an 8-year high of 7.8% in June, the jobless rate will improve slightly. I'm Eric Weiner in Washington.
United Nations officials say a 26-member team of inspectors will go to Baghdad Saturday to conduct another search for concealed weapons. Officials warn they will respond quickly if Baghdad tries to block the team's work. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The inspection will be the first since last month's aborted attempt to inspect the agriculture ministry in Baghdad. That incident led to a 3-week standoff between Iraq and the UN. It ended after Western officials threatened another military strike against Iraq. But UN officials say by then, Iraqi officials had apparently removed all of the incriminating material from the building. Rolf Akeas, the head of the Special Commission on Iraq, said today that he believes Iraq has learned a very serious lesson from the incident. He also said he had warned Iraqi officials that there will be very swift reaction if they interfere with the next inspection. Akeas would not say where the team members will be from. The UN was criticized for allowing Iraq to bar people from the United States or its Gulf War allies from the last team. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
And you're listening to National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. My guest, Archie Roach, is an Aboriginal singer-songwriter who doesn't sing the traditional music of his people. The Australian government forcibly took him away from his family when he was 3 years old. It was part of a government policy of assimilation, in which children were taken from Aboriginal society and placed in white foster homes. Now at the age of 37, Roach has his first album, Charcoal Lane, and he's on his first American tour. Many of his songs are autobiographical. This one is about the government policy that changed his life. It's called They Took the Children Away.
This story's right, this story's true. I would not tell lies to you, like the promises they did not keep, and how they fenced us in like sheep. Said to us, come take our hand, set us up on mission land, told us to read, to write and pray. Then they took the children away, took the children away, the children away. Snatched from their mother's breast, said this is for the best, took them away.
Do you have any memories of the time that you were with your family before the government took you away?
Not really. Sometimes I dream, and maybe that's a locked-in memory deep down. I dream about times and my parents, but I can't see their faces, so maybe that's it.
What was the story of the day you were taken away as it was told to you by relatives?
Mum and Dad were away at the time. It was usually the case when parents were away, particularly the fathers, that they would come. And if they weren't successful that time in getting any kids, they'd wait for another time. This is what I was told by my uncle. And my cousins tried to hide me. They were acted like decoys and tried to lead the police away and things like that, and the authorities from where I was, where they'd hid me, but they eventually found me.
So when you were taken away, were there other Aboriginal kids in the neighbourhoods that you grew up in, or were you always the only one?
No, they placed you in areas where there was no Aboriginal population.
So you were really alone, you were really isolated.
Yeah, but I didn't realise I was an Aboriginal person, or Indigenous person, until I was about 11.
What made you realise it?
I took a friend home one time from school. I never took people home much, but one time I did. Of course, he was a white friend. He was just a good friend. And as he left, he said, "They can't be your real parents, Archie. They're white." And I didn't realise it. For a time, I didn't question anything. It's really strange. I started to question things then.
When you were 14, I believe it was, you got a letter from your sister, who you hadn't seen since you were taken away from your family, that your mother had died. Was that the first time you'd heard from anyone in your family since you were taken away?
Yes.
How did that letter change your life?
It confused me. I was taken away when I was 3. I received a letter. I'd never seen my mother or father. Since then, I received a letter from this lady I'd never heard of, saying she was my sister and that my mother had passed away a week ago. I didn't know what to think. I asked people questions, and my foster family never really had any answers because they weren't told anything either. So I just ran away.
You ran away from your foster family?
I just ran away from everything. I just ran away from life.
When you ran away from the foster home, you lived on the streets, I believe in Melbourne. Where did you live exactly on the streets? What kind of streets?
Just in the city, in the parks, the gardens, alleyways. That's what we call it, alleyways, lanes. So that's why the title of the album, Charcoal Lane, I suppose you'd say Charcoal Alleyway or something. Yeah, there's a place we used to live up the back streets and alleyways and make sort of like little lean-tos where we used to live in and things like that.
Did you ever steal to get money? Or
yes.
To get food?
Yes. Yes, you know, I had no income. There was... I was too young to receive any social security. So at times you to survive, you had to steal, and you know, do some I suppose bad things. What people might regard as really really bad things, and I look back and I suppose they were, but it was either that or just die.
Did you get in trouble with the police? Were you ever arrested?
Yes, I was in and out of jail for certain things. I drank a lot of alcohol. I was alcoholic at 14. Sometimes I'd become violent. But it used to make me sick. I used to wonder why I used to get really sick. I thought it was drinking, but now I know what it was. Why I used to get really sick.
Why?
Because we were hunter-gatherers. We were gentle people. We were peaceful people. Violence and things like that aren't really a part of our spirit and nature. And that's why I became sick.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is
okay.
Fresh Air. My guest is Archie Roach. He's an Australian Aboriginal singer-songwriter. Let me play your song, Down City Streets. Does this describe your experience when you were homeless?
Yes, it does. It's pretty much how it was.
When did you write it?
Well, actually, if I may clarify, that was a song written by my wife.
Thank you for the only song on the album.
Yeah, she. I met my wife on the streets.
Well, let's hear Down City Streets.
Down city streets, I would roam. I had no bed, I had no home. Crawled out of bushes early morn. Used newspapers to keep me warm. Then I'd have to score a drink, start me up, help me to think. Down city streets I would roam, use my fingers as a comb.
That's Down City Streets from my guest Archie Roach's new album, Charcoal Lane. When you started writing songs, did you perform on the street?
Yes, I sang a little bit on the street. Most of the times I'd be too out of it, too drunk. But I'd sing to all my friends in the park. They were a pretty good audience, and they didn't seem to mind.
So what was your breakthrough when somebody heard you and realized you were talented and helped you start performing or recording?
Well, you'd have to go back a little bit. My wife had left me and my children. She took the children because she had enough. Not so much, well, I suppose, of me, but it could have been me, but just the lifestyle, and she wanted something better for herself and the children. So she left me, and I thought, great, you know, I'm a free man again, but it really wasn't like that at all. You can't deny your feelings. So I finally decided to do something about my drinking, and it wasn't until after then that I'd stopped drinking and dealt with that, and that took a while. Just the actual physical, stop drinking. It's more than that. My mind was so befuddled by alcohol. I picked up the pieces and I just got regular work, and sang mainly as something to do. Wrote songs and sang them around the community, various coffee lounges, and I just started getting a following, or people just started to, I don't know, like the songs and the music. So, but that wasn't, you know, that's how I sort of started it off.
And what was the next step?
About 3 years ago, I was at work, and somebody rang up and asked me if I wanted to perform at a Paul Kelly concert. Paul Kelly and the Messengers, they're an Australian. He's very well received in Australia and a few other places. Established musician and very popular. And it was a big break for me. So I went along and sang two songs at his concert, but I didn't realise how big his concerts were. And there was about 2,000 people in this auditorium. I was a little bit nervous, but I sang two songs. One was "Took the Beautiful Child" and "Took the Children Away." And when I'd finished, there was nothing. I couldn't. Yeah, there was no response or anything, and I said, "Oh, I've died. They really don't like me." So much for that. And I started to walk off stage, and I'd never heard of it before. I'd seen it on shows and TV and films where one person starts to clap, and then another, and then another, and then another, and then another. And before I knew it, before I actually got to the wings, there was this big roar of, you know. It sort of it took me back. I was taken aback a bit, and I didn't know what. I just stood there, and I didn't really know what to do. I just it felt good that people they did enjoy it. They did like it. So, but it took them a while to respond, I suppose.
So then, Paul Kelly, whose concert that you sang at, he helped get you a recording contract.
Well, he believed enough in me to talk to his record company, to the relevant people there, executives, and gave him a listen to some tapes, some demos that I'd done, and they decided to take a chance with me and produce Charcoal Lane.
Have you ever forgiven your government for this policy that took you and your wife away from your families?
Well, this is a policy that ended back in 1967. The assimilation policies, oddly enough, that was the same year we got the vote, the referendum, Aboriginal people. Hey, yeah, I just realised that. I don't feel any bitterness or hate. You know, I've been through all that. It got me in a lot of trouble and it made me sick.
Bitterness did?
Yes. Bitterness, if you eat anything bitter, it's not, you got to spit it out. It's sour. It's no good to take in. Yeah, if something's bitter in the mouth, the immediate reaction is to go, ah, spit it out. It's poison. That's how my uncle teaches me. And so, because it doesn't belong inside. And he said, I don't feel angry or bitter, Archie, I feel sad. And that's about it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Also want someone to say, to acknowledge that it happened. This happened through history to the Aboriginal people of Australia. And we're sorry. And that's all I want. That's all I want anyway.
Has anyone in the government ever said, we're sorry?
Not really. They talk about compensation and stuff like that. Money. Money. That's what got us into trouble in the first place. I just wanted to say, look, we're really sorry. Just someone there in power. I'll be happy then that these things happen. I can go on. I can put all this behind me.
Yeah. I want to thank you a lot for talking with us, and I wish you the best.
Thank you very much.
Archie Roach's new album, Charcoal Lane, is on High Tone Records. This month, he'll perform in Minneapolis, Chicago, Ann Arbor, Boston, New York, and Alexandria.
Sitting here in a lonely old guest house, I'm sure that my life is all through. Scratching fleas and watching the gray mouse, I'm making love to the memory of you. For without you, I'm weak and uncertain, and I feel so naked and cold, like a window without any curtain. My innermost feelings unfold. The drink I just had, it wasn't as bad as the first. But drinking more.
This is Fresh Air. I have a rundown of some of the stories coming up on All Things Considered. Ted Clark reports from Capitol Hill. Yesterday, the State Department said it had evidence of Serbian-operated concentration camps in Bosnia. Today, the Bush administration is backing off from that position. Patricia Naiman reports on why the administration has rejected the state of Oregon's novel approach to health care reform and what it means for other states trying to limit rising health care costs. Also, the high-tech zoo of the future. You can go there and view the animals by way of virtual reality. Those stories and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Susan Sontag is best known as a modernist critic and author of such influential essays as Against Interpretation, Styles of Radical Will, and Illness as Metaphor. The subject of her latest novel, The Volcano Lover, is surprising and improbable. Book critic John Leonard tells us why.
The surprise is not that Susan Sontag has finally written another novel, after 20 years of worrying about almost everything else in the contemporary culture. The surprise is that The Volcano Lover is a novel about the 18th century and written in the expansive, digressive, omniscient, unbuttoned style of the 19th century, full of splendid long-windedness, witty epigrams, historical hugger-mugger, subversive politics, grand opera, and grand guignol. Think of a sardonic Stendhal at the keyboard of Tolstoy's harmonium. Of course, Sontag being Sontag, there are 20th century ironies shadowing each of her 18th and 19th century pages. Looking down are such ghosts of modernism future as Vladimir Nabokov, Milan Kundera, and Ilias Canetti, whose monomaniacal masterpiece, Auto da Fe, is a kind of sign of Saturn over Sontag's symbolic volcano. What do these ghosts look down on? They look down on Naples from 1765 till 1805, while Vesuvius seethes. They look down on the French Revolution, Napoleon, Goethe, Mozart, and the Marquis de Sade. But especially they look down on Sir William Hamilton, the English ambassador to the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, and his second wife, Emma, the upwardly mobile playgirl of the Anglo-Saxon smart set, and Horatio Nelson, before, during, and after his ascension to Lord Admiral in the Bonaparte-bashing British Navy. If you saw Alexander Korda's 1941 movie, That Hamilton Woman, you will remember that Lord Nelson, played by Laurence Olivier, and Frau Emma, played by Vivian Leigh, had a love affair so shameless the whole empire blushed. But the movie, Winston Churchill's favorite, was pure British wartime propaganda, whereas Sontag's novel, which turns on its characters after allowing us to sympathize with them, is contemptuous of the English and unkind to Habsburgs, too. Hamilton collects things: Etruscan vases, Pompeii earrings, bronze javelins, amber dice. Indeed, Sontag does for the collecting mentality here what she's done elsewhere to photography, metaphor, and fascism. She deconstructs. But Hamilton also loves his Vesuvius, a sort of Moby Dick symbolic of everything from sexual passion to the unconscious, from porn to revolution, from Freudian death wish to modern art. No wonder he marries Emma, his very own volcano. Like Pygmalion, he will teach this Galatea to sing songs, speak in tongues, and attitudinize, which means after dinner, for their guests, she will impersonate Niobe, Medea, Iphigenia, Ariadne, and Dido. In other words, the usual male fantasies of mothers losing or killing their children, or of maidens dragged by their fathers to sacrificial altars, or maidens dying of despair at abandonment, or maidens stoned because they were raped. Once the one-eyed, one-armed Nelson falls for her, Emma will have another role to play. Pom-pom girl at the bloodbath. Because the collector, the attitudinizer, and the admiral will conspire after the French Revolution comes to Naples at a counter-revolutionary white terror from which there is no mercy and for which there is no excuse. In the brilliant concluding section of The Volcano Lover, the dead rise up to talk to us, and one of them says, "They thought they were civilized. They were despicable. Damn them all." So Sontag does, in a novel that is predictably brainy, surprisingly exhilarating, and amazingly commercial.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Susan Sontag's novel, The Volcano Lover. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Ron Barron, and Thad Kirk. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. We were directed today by Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Castro's Final Hour. Journalist Andres Oppenheimer has been covering Latin America for the past 15 years. His new book describes how Castro's socialist revolution destroyed itself after the collapse of world communism. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.